Welcome to Washington Today for October 11th, 2021. I'm Gary Starkoff. Thanks for joining us. Here are some of today's headlines. The House will vote tomorrow on the Senate-approved bill to raise the debt ceiling. The bill will allow the country to pay its bills until about December 3rd, which is also the date the continuing resolution to fund the government expires. Today is Indigenous Peoples Day, and this year marks the first time a U.S. president has officially recognized it. On Friday, President Joe Biden issued a proclamation honoring the day, and Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, who is a member of the Pueblo Laguna Nation, also marked the occasion. And drug manufacturer Merck says it may have a pill that will fight COVID-19. Trials show the pill, when taken when symptoms begin, cuts the risk of hospitalization and death in half. We begin on this federal holiday by marking the first time a sitting president has officially recognized the day as Indigenous Peoples Day. On Friday, President Biden issued a proclamation that reads, in part, quote, "the contributions that Indigenous peoples have made throughout history in public service, entrepreneurship, scholarship, the arts, and countless other fields are integral to our nation, our culture, and our society. Today, we acknowledge the significant sacrifices made by Native peoples to this country and recognize their many ongoing contributions to our nation." And in a separate proclamation marking Columbus Day, the president also acknowledged the, quote, "wrongs and atrocities that European explorers brought to Native communities." You can see both statements at whitehouse.gov. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, a member of the Pueblo Laguna Nation, is also marking the day by running the Boston Marathon. She wrote in an op-ed in the Boston Globe, quote, "I started running about 20 years ago. Along the way to running my first marathon, I began to think deeply about the story of my people who have used running not only to get places, but to preserve their traditions and culture. I run because my ancestors gave me this ability." She also released this message on Twitter today.
Gwatsi Haupa, happy Indigenous Peoples Day, everyone. Today we celebrate the rich traditions, diverse cultures, and resilience of Indigenous communities. I'm incredibly proud to honor the first stewards of this land, the Indigenous people who survived through periods of brutal colonization and eventually forced assimilation policies. We are strong and we are still here. We are the dreams our ancestors had when they practiced and passed down our customs, languages, and traditions. At Interior, we work hard to honor our promises to Native American, Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian, and island communities. This Indigenous Peoples Day, I'm grateful for those who came before me, for my mother who taught me what it was to be a Pueblo woman, and for my child who will carry our traditions long after I'm gone. Happy Indigenous Peoples Day, everyone.
That's Interior Secretary Deb Haaland. On Capitol Hill today, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer said the House will vote tomorrow on the Senate-passed bill that will raise the debt limit until December. The bill raises the debt limit by $480 billion, which the Treasury Department says will allow it to pay its bills until December 3rd. The current national debt is about $28.4 trillion and would rise to about $28.8 trillion. Leader Hoyer said in his statement in part that, quote, "due to the fact that Senate Republicans refused to advance House-passed legislation to responsibly raise the debt limit and chose to put the United States' full faith and credit at risk, the Senate has passed a temporary stopgap measure. Therefore, the House will convene on Tuesday, October 12th, to pass this stopgap measure, and I expect we will complete our work that evening. It is egregious that our nation has been put in this spot, but we must take immediate action to address the debt limit and ensure the full faith and credit of the United States remains intact." You can read the entire statement at majorityleader.gov. House Ways and Means Ranking Member Kevin Brady also spoke about this debt ceiling vote and the Biden administration's agenda.
Is anything going to change by the end of October? And have you noticed we're going to do it by Halloween, trick or treat? Did you notice the timing there? I don't think that's a coincidence, is it?
Maybe not, Joe. So one, I think you're exactly right. Debt ceiling does get done. It always does. Look, we've known this day is coming for 2 years. No budget's been passed in the last couple of years. No discussions on how to do it. But yeah, it'll be done tomorrow. Secondly, look, I think this jobs report on Friday didn't help Democrats find consensus. The president's almost a million jobs short already of what he promised from his last $2 trillion COVID package. We are not seeing any progress in the worker shortage on Main Street and all throughout the supply chain. Obviously, prices continue. We're on track to hit a 40-year high on prices. And while wages are going up, families seem to be falling back each month. So I think this makes it more difficult for them, especially with Americans losing confidence now in the president's economic leadership. That approval's now in the 30s range. I think those what moderate Democrats are left, I think they're good people, but I think they now know they are on their own. You know, the president doesn't care about them. Speaker Pelosi doesn't care. Certainly their colleagues don't care about them. I think at the end of the day, they hold the future of whether we see these taxes and $5 trillion of spending go forward. I think it's a 50-50 shot this collapses.
House Ways and Means Ranking Member Kevin Brady of Texas talking on CNBC earlier today. Of course, the debt ceiling does not authorize new government spending, but allows the Treasury Department to pay the bills for previous spending. A whistleblower who says they are a former high-ranking U.S. Capitol Police official is criticizing the department's leadership before, during, and after the deadly January 6th insurrection. The 16-page letter, which was obtained by CNN and first reported by Politico, claims two Capitol Police officials, Assistant Chief Yogananda Pittman and Acting Assistant Chief Sean Gallagher, did not share vital intelligence with leadership and did not act to help once the violence began on January 6th. The letters, dated September 28th, was addressed to leaders of the House and Senate. And yesterday on Fox News Sunday, House Minority Whip Steve Scalise spoke about the events of January 6th.
If it comes to a vote in the House for resisting these subpoenas and holding the people who resist the subpoenas in criminal contempt of Congress, how will you vote?
Well, first of all, these are legal issues, and you've got a number of people that have been subpoenaed that are complying. They're trying to comply, but it's a legal process, and, you know, they've got attorneys. By the way, the House of Representatives, Speaker Pelosi, spent millions of taxpayer dollars hiring attorneys, too. And there's Justice Department cases moving forward. They've arrested hundreds of people.
No, but I'm not, but sir,
I
don't mean to interrupt, but we're running out of time. Specifically, the way it would come to the court is they would resist the subpoena, and then the House would vote to hold them in criminal contempt, and then it would go to the court. And my question is, if it comes to a vote on the House floor to hold these people who are ignoring House committee subpoenas to produce documents or testify, how would you vote?
Well, I don't speculate on a bill that's not before me. It's not before me right now. I voted against this commission because it was heavily stacked to be a partisan commission. Look, they don't want to spend any time investigating the origin of COVID. That, by the way, matters to the families of over 600,000 Americans. They don't want to hold an investigation into what happened in Afghanistan, the complete botched withdrawal that led to 13 American soldiers dying. Why don't they focus on getting our economy back on track, get an FDA commissioner to get COVID under control? They want to keep revisiting last year, the year before.
Well, sir, I mean, in fairness, Republicans, when you were in control, wanted to go over Benghazi, and that was a perfectly legitimate thing. Four Americans died. This was the worst attack in at least a century or more on the U.S. Capitol. Let me ask you one last question in this regard. Clearly, there were irregularities in the last election. There are irregularities in all elections. But I want to ask you a specific question. Do you think the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump? And in continuing to make that charge, not having states do election reforms, but specifically making this charge that the election was stolen, do you think that that hurts, undermines American democracy?
Well, Chris, I've been very clear from the beginning. If you look at a number of states, they didn't follow their state-passed laws that govern the election for president. That is what the United States Constitution says. They don't say that the states determine what the rules are. They say the state legislatures determine the rules.
But the states all certified.
In a number of states, they didn't follow those state legislative
rules. The states
all
certified.
They didn't follow those legislative rules. Right. But at the end of the day, are we going to follow what the Constitution says or not? I hope we get back to what the Constitution says. But clearly, in a number of states, they didn't follow those legislatively
set rules. So you think the election was stolen?
What I said is there are states that didn't follow their legislatively set rules. That's what the United States Constitution says. And I think there are a lot of people that want us to get back to what the Constitution says we should be doing, not just with elections, with a lot of other things, too.
House Minority Whip Steve Scalise of Louisiana yesterday on Fox News Sunday. Also speaking about the events of January 6th was Adam Schiff, who's chair of the House Intelligence Committee and a member of the House Committee investigating the attacks.
First, let's fast forward to January 6th. You start out the book in pretty dramatic fashion, having to put on a gas mask you thought you would never use as a member of Congress.
Well, I remember when the police officer said, grab your masks, thinking, masks? Are there masks here? And he told us they were under the seats. Now I've been in Congress for 20 years. I didn't know there were gas hoods under the seats. The whole thing was just surreal. Once you took out those masks, a fan started, and there was suddenly this buzzing all over the chamber. And people were becoming increasingly panicked and shouting. I remember first running into one of the Republicans and saying, you know, we're talking about what was going on. And I asked him, how long have you been here? Because he had a member pin, but I didn't recognize him. And he said, 72 hours. And I said, 72 hours? And he said, yes, I just got elected. And all I could say was, it's not always like this. I couldn't imagine being a new member and facing this, but I couldn't imagine any of us facing this. I couldn't imagine there were people climbing outside the building. We started to hear the windows shattering. The police were shouting at us to get out. And some of the Republicans were telling me, you can't let them see you. I remember one saying, you know,
because you were so high profile.
Yeah. And my first inclination was to be oddly touched that they were worried about my safety. And then my next inclination was to be angry because had they not been pushing out these lies about me, certainly, but also about the election, none of us would have to be worried about our security. And frankly, in the days after, when the trauma for a lot of us became even greater, I was most angry at these insurrectionists in suits and ties, these colleagues of mine who knew it was a lie, because a lot of the people attacking that Capitol believed the lie. But the people I work with, George, and I get asked about this all the time, do the Republican members really believe what they're saying? They know it's a lie. They know the election wasn't rigged, it wasn't stolen, but they just don't have the guts to speak the truth. And to me, that's unforgivable.
House January 6th committee member Adam Schiff earlier today on ABC News Good Morning America. Drug manufacturer Merck says it may have a pill that will fight COVID-19. Trials show that the pill, when taken when symptoms begin, cuts the risk of hospitalization and death in half. The company says the results of their phase 3 trial were so promising they ended it early in consultation with the FDA. The study looked at 775 non-hospitalized adult patients with mild to moderate symptoms and at least one risk factor for severe illness. Through 29 days, no deaths were reported in patients who received the drug, compared to 8 deaths in patients who got a placebo. The drug is also effective against the Delta and other COVID variants. Merck has submitted the drug to the FDA for emergency use authorization. And with COVID cases flat or declining across the country, former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb talked about where he sees the pandemic going from here.
Well, look, I'm hopeful that this Delta wave of infection is the last major surge of infection that we see. And on the back end of this, we're going to start to evolve more from a pandemic phase of this virus, at least here in the United States, into more of an endemic phase where this virus becomes a chronic virus, becomes a constant nuisance. But we don't see the extreme amount of virus that we're seeing right now. It becomes sort of a second circulating flu. I think that in and of itself is menacing, and we're going to need to do things differently in the wintertime if we have COVID circulating alongside flu. But we're not going to see the kinds of extreme outbreaks that we're seeing right now, for example, that we saw in the South and we're seeing right now in the Midwest and the Plain States. That's really causing us to have to reorient our society and change the way we do things. I think we're going to learn how to coexist with this virus. This virus is going to be persistent. It's going to be a menace. It's going to claim lives every year, but we're going to learn how to reduce its impact through both vaccination as well as better therapeutics that are going to be coming on the market and better practices when it comes to respiratory health inside confined spaces like workplaces and other kinds of forms of recreation where you get a lot of people congregating indoors and creating the conditions where this virus is easily spread.
The book, Uncontrolled Spread, Why COVID-19 Crushed Us and How We Can Defeat the Next Pandemic. You talk a lot about the future, but also look back at the earliest days of this pandemic. You write in that book, to those who suffered and died and to the rising generation in our country, we owe a clear-eyed review of the facts. What did we get right and what did we get wrong? That's one of the questions you pose. How do you answer it?
Well, look, I think what we got wrong was that we didn't really have a capacity in this nation to mobilize the kind of response that we needed. There was a perception that CDC would be able to mount the kind of logistical response that was needed in crisis, being able to develop and mass deploy diagnostic testing, being able to stand up mass vaccination sites, being able to collect information in a real-time fashion and do quick analytical work to inform policymakers on what they ought to be doing, inform consumers in a timely fashion as well. And CDC really wasn't a crisis-oriented organization. It didn't have the operational or logistical capacity to mount that kind of response. It's a high-science organization. It's deeply retrospective. It does careful, backward-looking analyses and takes its time to be sort of the definitive word on a question, not the first word on a question. We really don't have an operational capacity to respond to a public health crisis of this magnitude. We don't have sort of a FEMA or a DOD, a Department of Defense, when it comes to public health, and we're going to need to build that capacity. I don't think we need to create a new agency. I think this needs to reside within CDC, but it needs to be a much different component within CDC. We also didn't have the base of manufacturing that we thought we would have in a time of a crisis. We really couldn't scale up quickly the manufacturing of drugs, the monoclonal antibodies, small molecule drugs like the new Merck drug that they filed for approval today. It looks very promising, including the vaccines. I think there was this perception that you can keep what we used to call a warm base of preparedness, that you could have facilities that you would sort of overbuild and maybe mothball, and they'd be ready in a time of crisis. And what we learned is that that doesn't work, that in order to keep a facility ready when you need it in a time of crisis, it has to be hot. It has to be in constant operation. And so we're going to need to figure out how to operate certain components of our manufacturing base, not necessarily for maximal efficiency, but maximal resiliency, building more resiliency into the system. And then finally, on that data question, we didn't have the capacity to collect information in a real-time fashion to inform ourselves of what was going on and then do the quick analytical work that would help us ascertain how this virus was spreading, what the social and geographic compartments of spread were, what the conditions were that were conducive to spread. And so we were wiping down our groceries thinking that this was spreading through contaminated surfaces when it was really spreading through aerosols in confined closed spaces through asymptomatic carriers. It took us much too long to figure that out. And that's because we didn't have good analytical work and didn't have good information to be able to ascertain those truths about this virus. And so that's another capability that we lacked. We're going to need to invest in building it out. And one final point I will make, and this is my closing thought on in terms of what we need to do differently, and the book has a lot of focus on what needs to change. I think we need to change the global situation. We've relied for a very long time on multilateral commitments between nations to share information when they're host to an emerging infection like this. And we've seen time and time again that nations have not been forthcoming with that information. And going forward, I think we're going to need to get our clandestine services, our intelligence agencies, much more engaged in the overseas mission of monitoring for bio threats and emerging infections globally. We can't just rely on the good graces of other nations to inform us, to raise their hand when they're host to a new infection. We're going to need to have the tools to actually actively gather that information to protect ourselves.
Former Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Scott Gottlieb on C-SPAN's Washington Journal this morning. You can see the whole interview at cspan.org/WJ. Also talking about the state of the pandemic, President Biden's chief medical officer, Dr. Anthony Fauci. He was asked about keeping safe during the Halloween season.
I think that particularly if you're vaccinated, but you can get out there, you're outdoors for the most part, at least when my children were out there doing trick-or-treating, and enjoy it. I mean, this is a time that children love. It's a very important part of the year for children. I know my children enjoyed it. So, I mean, again, particularly if you're vaccinated, if you're not vaccinated, again, think about it, that you'll add an extra degree of protection to yourself and your children and your family and your community. So it's a good time to reflect on why it's important to get vaccinated, but go out there and enjoy Halloween as well as the other holidays that will be coming up.
Dr. Anthony Fauci on CNN's State of the Union program yesterday. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. A U.S. Navy nuclear engineer and his wife have been charged with selling secret information about the Navy's submarine program and were caught by an FBI operation. Jonathan Toby is said to have passed a package of classified data to an unidentified foreign country last year, according to the Justice Department. Later, he began selling information to an undercover FBI agent posing as a foreign operative for payments in cryptocurrency totaling $100,000. Court documents say that at one point he hid a digital memory card containing sensitive information on nuclear submarine reactors in half a peanut butter sandwich. The sandwich was left at a dead drop in West Virginia while his wife Diana acted as a lookout. Another was hidden in a pack of chewing gum. Authorities say the couple are from Annapolis, Maryland, and were arrested during one of their drops in West Virginia. They are being charged with violating the Atomic Energy Act. Ahead of the United Nations Climate Change Conference, the World Health Organization is warning in a new report the impacts of climate change could roll back 50 years of global health progress. It also says the first and worst impacts will be in the countries that have polluted the least. Some of the risks include more extreme weather, an increase in heat and waterborne illness, malnutrition from failing crops, and an increase in the diseases that can be transmitted from animals to humans. The UN's COP26 meeting is set to take place beginning October 31st in Glasgow, Scotland. U.S. officials and senior Taliban officials held their second day of talks in Qatar on Sunday. It's the first direct talks between the two sides since the American withdrawal from Afghanistan in August. CIA Deputy Director David Cohen is leading the U.S. delegation. A senior State Department spokesman told CBS News that the meetings are not about, quote, recognition or confirming legitimacy to the Taliban. Here's more from CBS News senior foreign correspondent Elizabeth Palmer on what's at stake in the talks.
What they really want from America is about $7 billion worth of frozen assets. It's held in U.S. bonds and in gold in the U.S. So when the Taliban took over and showed up at the central bank thinking, great, let's get our hands on the money to run the country, it wasn't there. About 75% of the money that they need to run the country is actually held abroad. So that for them is number one. They need cash to make sure they can stay in power and you know, provide basic services and so on.
Elizabeth, why is the CIA taking a lead role?
Well, intelligence agency, they will have had really good evaluation, continuing evaluation of how things are progressing and were progressing as the Taliban began to consolidate their hold on the country. And they have some relationships established. Before the U.S. pulled out, the CIA director, William Burns, met with the representatives of the Taliban. So there's some personal contact there. And the CIA, well, has many gifted linguists and so on. So they're in a good position to drive a very delicate but hard bargain, because the U.S. will want something if it's going to give back any of those frozen funds.
Well, speaking of that, what might the U.S. ask as concessions from the Taliban in order to unfreeze their foreign currency reserves?
Well, two main things. So there are probably thousands of Afghans still trapped inside Afghanistan who are either green card holders or might qualify for special visas. Perhaps they work for the U.S. forces and so on. The U.S. wants to get some concessions, some promise from the Taliban that they will be allowed to leave in an orderly fashion over the next little while. So the evacuations is one. And then two, women's rights. You know, already girls aren't allowed to go to high school in many parts of Afghanistan. Women public servants aren't allowed to go to work. All women judges have told to stay home. The United States would like to try and get some concessions from the Taliban on those very important issues. They apparently did say, we can help you with ISIS. You know, ISIS has carried out some very bloody bombings. They are sworn enemies of the Taliban, and really there's a turf war going on there between this regional ISIS group, ISIS-K, and the Taliban. And the U.S. said, look, we can help you control
ISIS. But the Taliban apparently has said, no, we can do that ourselves.
CBS News senior foreign correspondent Elizabeth Palmer. And as we heard, another top issue for U.S. officials in their talks with the Taliban, the ongoing situation for women and girls in the country. Today in Lisbon, Portugal, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi spoke on that topic, where she received the Women for Peace and Security Award at the 67th annual session of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Here's a portion of her remarks.
Right now, when we talk about Afghanistan, it's so much in our hearts and our minds. I wear this ring given to me by the women of made by the women of Afghanistan. I've been there many, many times over the last 20 years. And we visited the women, and of course, in Kabul, the very accomplished women, lawyers, doctors, university heads, leaders in every way, and so impressive. But also to visit in the hinterlands, the poorest of the poor women, beggars, really, people working in agriculture and the rest, who are very poor but were very thrilled that their daughters could go to school. But one time I was on a trip, took a fixed wing, helicopter, armored car. Practically, I thought we were going to ride a donkey to get to where these people were. So remote were the regions we were going to. The women said, we just want to meet with you alone. No men. We had a women's delegation. We would take a women delegation of women to visit the women many times. And those women, as poor as they were, they said, you want us to send our daughters to school, and we want to do that. You want them to take advantage of health centers. We want them to go there, but we cannot let them leave the house until we have security. And we can't have security until we end corruption in our country. Imagine, as unsophisticated, they were educated in many ways, but not formally, they understood the connection between freedom and ending corruption. So we cannot ever forget them, and I want to salute NATO, because the NATO alliance was so instrumental for having a whole generation, 20 years of women and girls, to receive educations that what they would have never received without the NATO presence, the allies, the alliances in Afghanistan. Now we cannot let that go slip away. We must keep our focus there, keep these women close to our hearts as we go forward, because it's not just about the women, it's about what it means for Afghanistan. It's not just about Afghanistan. It's what it means about security in the world, the women of Afghanistan.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi earlier today in Lisbon, Portugal, speaking to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. A reminder that all of our coverage is online anytime at cspan.org. And if you missed any of this program, you can find it at cspan.org/podcasts, on the new C-SPAN Now app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington delivered right to your inbox, you can subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Gary Sterikoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.